Well, hello, ladies and gentlemen. Please find your way to the seat. Well, a warm greeting to you to this evening at the Round Church. The Round Church is the home of Christian Heritage, and it's a delight to have Mike Pierce with us visiting and giving a talk to us this evening. So Christian Heritage exists to explore the relationship between the historic Christian faith and history and our contemporary culture. Mike is a visiting professor at Houghton College, and he's the author of 7 books, which is a fabulous number, and he's going to be speaking to us this evening on the topic of becoming modern, recreating past, present, and future. Mike's going to speak to us for about an hour, and then following that, there'll be a short time of Q&A, which we'll go straight into after the talk. So without further ado, please welcome Mike Pierce.
Well, thank you very much. Good evening, everybody. Just as a quick aside before I even start, I would say that... and I don't want to say too much about this because it could become a very long digression. A lot of my career over the last quarter century has been involved not simply in teaching students, as you might expect, first in the London School of Theology, and then over the last 15 years in Houghton College in the frozen tundra of Western New York, but increasingly involved with the Balkans. And the Balkans has taught me all things. In particular, by just listening to people, talking with them about the ordinary aspects of their life, I was finally forced to confront, around the age of 40, I guess, just how radically different a society the modern West has become, that the process of modernization has created something unique in the world. Sometimes in a good way, sometimes not at all in a good way. And I have been grappling with the issues raised by that reality ever since. Right? So what I want us to think about tonight is how the process of becoming modern makes us think differently about time and makes us very different kinds of people to all of our ancestors. Because there's a tendency of all of us to think that, well, being modern means being prosperous, employing technology to create efficiency, cleanliness, an ability to do all kinds of things that we couldn't do before. And certainly that's the instinct of most of my students. They think that's what being modern is. And that, although they wouldn't generally articulate it this way, if you interrogate them hard enough, and I do because I'm horrible to them, this is the greatest joy in life. Right? Fancy being paid a decent salary to get up every morning and tease the living heck out of somebody else's kids. I mean, there's nothing better than that. Nothing beats that. So, but if you interrogate them about this, they do think, and they are encouraged in this by the fatuous products of the entertainment industry, that basically everybody in the past was just like a low-tech version of themselves. Right. Well, let's just take that as our starting point and move in from there. A recent essay by one of my students about the impact of Enlightenment thought in the 18th century provoked me to the following comment in the margin. None of the excellent books you've cited lends the least support for your repeated statement that Enlightenment ideas were embraced most by industrial workers and peasants. I have no idea what possible sources can have led you to this insistence, except perhaps for the fatuous and all too popular construal of all past regimes as a sort of trick played on the poor who spent countless ages just waiting for George Clooney to turn up and show them how to live. It wasn't a bad paper, relatively speaking, in that it was at least written in coherent sentences and seemed to have consulted, probably had consulted, proper history books. My little drop of acid was just a variant on a more frequent comment I make on similar first-year papers about either the Renaissance or the Enlightenment, papers which, despite all my warnings, frequently include garbage about the people, who were they, starting to think for themselves. In the margin, I tend to put something like, did none of them do this before? Were they all college freshmen? For several centuries now, Westerners have been brought up to think all their ancestors stupid. And no amount of acid poured out by me in a single semester class, oh, hang on, we've got our papers jumbled up here, can do more than dent that misplaced confidence. So I tend to ask my students something like this. To think about who epitomizes, perhaps, the modern or postmodern idea of a benighted ancestor who understood nothing, who did not think for themselves. And they will generally suggest the idea of the medieval peasant. So I ask them to think about what kind of things an illiterate medieval peasant could do, and then compare those abilities with the abilities of, say, my students. Well, the illiterate medieval peasant could tell one plant from another, could get some idea of the weather, the likely weather, from changes in the natural environment around them, knew how to plough a field and to tend and to look after crops, knew how to care for animals and then to kill them and skin them and make food from them. Can my students do any of these things? Can they even cook, even with all the accoutrements of a modern kitchen at their instant disposal? The medieval peasant knew how to build a house, generally how to make a roof, how to care for and look after tools, not generally to make them. That was a specialized occupation, blacksmiths especially. Right? How would that look? How do we compare? Well, again, not terribly well. Finally, the medieval peasant could read religious art better than I can, and I'm a historian. Right? Now, it's not that I'm not interested. I'm extremely interested. But I've found over the years it's just so difficult to remember all of the details, the symbolic significance of colours and details in pictures, which medieval peasants could read much better than I can. Now, I have no doubt at all that if the medieval peasant could come back and talk to us and to give an opinion, he would consider me, as much as my students, to be the ignorant and useless buffoon. So why the insistence upon our ancestors' stupidity? Is this a sort of a universal human trait? Did the medieval peasant, for example, think the same about his own forebears? On the contrary, in all traditional societies, ancestors were actually revered. In some, worshipped. Wisdom consisted in following the ways of one's ancestors, and the reason for that was almost mind-bogglingly simple. If they hadn't succeeded in staying alive and passing their ways down to us, nowadays we might also say their genes, right, we would not be here. Right? Our ancestors constituted success stories by definition. Innovators, and there were such before the modern world, though they're not very many, they had to answer the constant accusation that they were arrogant, that they were vaunting their own judgment above the proven ways of their forefathers. So pre-modern people believed in tradition and the duty of following the ways of their ancestors. And insofar as they visualized their own lives, they saw themselves as a link in the chain running from the past to the future. Now, in an obvious chronological sense, that's blindingly obviously true of all of us. But you and I don't tend to see ourselves that way. Pre-modern people very consciously did. We have received a bequest from our ancestors, which it is the central duty of our lives to pass on to our children. Their duty was to bequeath to their descendants what they had received. Now, Edmund Burke, writing towards the end of this way of thinking, at least in fast-changing Western countries, expresses this very well. He was writing in 1790-91 against the revolution in France. And he's writing in view of the old way of looking at things. He says that with revolutionaries, it's a sufficient motive to destroy an old scheme of things because it is an old one. As to the new, there is no sort of fear with regard to the duration of a building run up in haste, because duration is no object to those who think little or nothing has been done before their time and who place all their hopes in discovery, by which he meant changes for the future. Now, you think about that. Look at this building where we are right now. It was built in the 12th century. Now, of course, most buildings from the 12th century have not survived. They were wooden hovels. But public buildings, very, very many have. And they were consciously erected as something for the ages. Is there anything at all that is being built right now that its builders expect still to be there and admired by future ages, even 200 or 300 years from now? Right? And I think that's almost a rhetorical question. The obvious answer is no, there's nothing. Right? It's a completely different mentality that we have. A spirit of innovation, he says, and sorry, let me just tell you here, this is being written at the end of the 18th century. In the 16th and 17th century, innovation was used, at least amongst English people, when they were having arguments, particularly the time of the Civil War, universally as a term of condemnation. If you and I are having an argument and I accuse you of innovation, I can make the charge stick. You are ipso facto in the wrong. Right. That's starting to slip a bit by Burke's time, but he still tends to think that way. A spirit of innovation is generally the result of a selfish temper and confined views. The innovator is narrow-minded. Huh? We've been taught the opposite. How can this be so? Because the innovator is vaunting their own judgment against the tried and proven wisdom of our ancestors. Now, I'm not necessarily endorsing that argument, though I tilt that way a bit. I'm simply telling you that it is so. That is how pre-modern people thought, and insofar as many people around the world today remain unmodernized, still tend to think. Right? People will not look forward to posterity who never look backward to their ancestors. Remember that sentence, we shall return to it at the end. Oh, hang on a minute. Okay, so according to that traditional view of the world, decay in human affairs was far likelier than progress. Change wasn't necessarily for the worse, but the presumption was still against it. Now, in the 15th and 16th centuries, the Renaissance and the Reformation first began a partial break from this view of things, though even they, if you know your basic history there, will know that they appealed to a more distant and so more authoritative past in the classical and early Christian worlds against the immediate past of the Middle Ages. Just to recapitulate there, so Renaissance scholars, for example, vilified some of the work that had gone before them. That's not a very pre-modern way to talk and to act, but they did so by saying, no, because look, we should be comparing ourselves with ancient Greece and Rome. Look at how they wrote. Look at how they produced art. We need to produce stuff like that. So they're still in that discourse. It's a partial break. The Protestant reformers are vilifying the teachings of the Catholic Church, but they're saying, but look what happened in the patristic period. Right? That's what we need to be referring ourselves to, a more distant and so more authoritative past. It's partially starting to, we refer to that period as the early modern period for a reason. Right? We're starting to break up this traditional view of the world. And by the late 18th century, it's palpably falling apart, not amongst the average ploughman out in a village somewhere, but at the social level of Burke and parliamentarians and educated people. Okay. And then, so in the 18th century, Enlightenment thinkers declared a belief in progress. Human affairs, they said, were not getting worse and worse, they were getting better and better. The older, the worse. The ancestors were stupid. And Westerners have tended to believe at least the last part of that judgment ever since. So no wonder my students' essays, like the writings of the 18th and 19th century ideologues, abound with language about people being, quote, blind. And about them starting to realize, about Enlightenment thinkers helping them to see, etc. Right? If I had a penny for every time a student had written those phrases in papers for me about the Renaissance or the Enlightenment for that matter, I would be a wealthier man than I am. The expressions themselves make apparent the supreme confidence of an entire population that only a modern Western view of things counts as rational, as truly seeing. And in this view, all else, whatever it is, and who cares what it is anyway, is just so much mumbo-jumbo. Right? I've been caricaturing the way that we've been brought up to think, but that's about right, I think. In fact, however, my students do not adhere to the modernist belief in progress. That died the death during the 20th century. Modernists had disbelieved in tradition and elevated their ideologies, which they insisted enshrined progress and a perfect future, for the sake of which they were prepared, as events proved, to torch the earth and kill millions. This, to put the matter mildly, did not work out well. Postmodern people, therefore, continue to be scornful of their ancestors and of tradition, but also scornful of the modernist ideologies. Indeed, they fear their world is coming to an end as a result of ecological catastrophe, which perhaps it is. This is a point we'll return to at the end. So modern people believed in progress. The world's getting better and better. Our ancestors were misguided and unjust, and we need to free ourselves from their beliefs and practices. So their duty was to make a better humanity and a better future, for the sake of which hardships may need to be borne and violence perpetrated in the present. Right? There's the history of the 19th and 20th centuries in a nutshell for you. So, and here's Thomas Paine expressing precisely that view, Burke's antagonist. Every generation is and must be competent to all the purposes which its occasions require. It's the living and not the dead that are to be accommodated. Postmodern people, however, disbelieve in both tradition, which they have been brought up to think of as unjust, stupid, and wrong, and progress, because it's disproved by the catastrophes of the 20th century and looming environmental disaster. The conclusion? Well, live for the present. Single-issue politics, hedonism, loss of identity and direction. History could be going anywhere. Probably not a good place, actually. But the answer is not to return to tradition. And apathy. And that, again, describes, I think, where we're at. Well, what about traditional views of the past? What were those like? Well, I'm going to touch on just some. The cyclical view, held by a number of non-Christian ways of thinking, most notably in Hinduism. The cyclical view of history, the idea that things go around, what goes around comes around, This accounts for visible change in the world as we look around us, but insists upon something like stasis in the longer term. Then the Christian and Jewish idea introduces the idea of linear time, that there is progress from the creation, there's a beginning of time, there's a creation, creator God who creates the universe. That puts time into motion. And we are somewhere along that timeline, and finally it's all going to be wrapped up, the second coming of Christ. Traditional views of the past also tended to conflate people and events. And it also tended to emphasize the sort of heroes and great men view of history. These conceptions are all very different. In practice, these traditional views often overlapped, although the first two didn't really overlap, but the others did overlap with one another and with each of the first two. They all had one central feature in common. Tradition was a trust. It's an enormous gift from our ancestors, which it was our life's duty to hand on to our children. Now, as is generally known, it was the Renaissance and then more acutely the Reformation that saw a departure from at least some of these older ways of looking at things. Neither the extent of that departure nor the pace of change should be exaggerated. Whether or not history is cyclical, the popularity of the theory that it is most certainly cyclical, keeps coming back. Think of Oswald Spengler's classic work of 1921, The Decline of the West, which is an exercise in thinking about a cyclical view of history. Or a postmodern Macedonian movie that I've showed many of my students is called Before the Rain. The key line in that movie is, the circle is not round. And it's full of pseudo-profundities, that movie, I'm afraid, although it's still a good movie. But the idea is that we are locked into a circle. It's not a perfectly round circle because no revolution is exactly like the one before it, but we come back to the same kind of place. And these views characterize societies in crisis or decline and give a certain consolation about the inevitability of the present disaster and the vague hope that sometime in the distant future the scales will again be reversed. So the cyclical view is very popular, as I say, in societies that are clearly in decline. Now, the West is very clearly in decline right now. I would not be at all surprised to see this view of history making quite a comeback over the next few decades. The tendency to conflate people and events, we see this, for example, in things like the miracle stories attributed to medieval saints, which are nearly always picked up and borrowed wholesale from, usually from Old Testament miracle stories, and then simply attributed to medieval saints, things like that. Or conflating a whole bunch of people with one supposed mythic hero. As you already have realized, I think, I've said I'm heavily involved with the Balkans. I take students there every year. And I take them to a little town on the coast of Croatia called Krk. And there's a little castle there. It was built by the Frankopan dynasty during the 11th to 13th centuries, I would have said. As part of our activities there, we go to visit a local high school where some of my freshman students can meet people in the last year of high school in Croatia. So they're near-age peers and just chat with one another, compare experiences, and that's always kind of amusing. And I overheard one conversation of a young man from the town explaining to my students about this castle. Well, there was a man called Frankopan who built this, and I just started laughing. It's classic, right? So, people do tend to conflate things. It's a natural instinct, particularly of uneducated people everywhere. Some of you who are familiar with C.S. Lewis, you might remember he observed right back in 1945 that in the minds of people like this, the past is a sort of comic jungle in which highwaymen, Queen Elizabeth, knights in armour, etc., wander about. The focus upon past heroes is actually fully consonant with what most societies, or very, very many societies did, which is dating by regnal years. I don't know if you realise this, but the Christian dating system isn't invented until about the early 6th century. And one of the disadvantages is it calculated the date of the birth of Christ wrongly, which means that everybody since has concluded that Jesus was actually born in 4 BC or something like that. Right? But even then, it wasn't generally used, it wasn't in universal use until much more recent times still. So the focus on heroes and great men is consonant with the idea of dating by regnal years, by the reigns of a king, which is, of course, what the Romans did and carried on in the Middle Ages. But the past was primarily a quarry of... of authoritative precedents and models for emulation and warnings or models for avoidance. Let's consider this man, Niccolo Machiavelli. Of course, he's got a very bad press, but he has some worryingly profound insights into the ways that statecraft and politics actually work. The Romans, he says, foresaw coming troubles in good time and always applied the necessary remedies. Actually, that can't be true, can it? Otherwise, the Roman Empire would still be existing. Anyway, and they never allowed them to continue in order to avoid a war, for they knew that war cannot in fact be avoided, but only postponed to the advantage of the other side. So they fought Philip and Antiochus in Greece in order not to have to fight them in Italy. As to the exercise of the mind, a prince ought to read history. He should consider the actions of great men, see how they conducted themselves in war, examine the reasons for their victories and defeats, so as to be able to avoid the latter and imitate the former. Above all, he should do what other great men in the past have done, and take as a model some earlier figure who's earned great praise and glory, keeping his actions and exploits always in mind, as it's said that Alexander the Great imitated Achilles, Julius Caesar imitated Alexander, and Scipio imitated Cyrus. Well, that's not quite how we use history now, but it's certainly how many people have done in the past insofar as they used it at all. This is a much more sophisticated approach than what uneducated people will have taken, which is, will have been simply to look at mythic heroes. Right? And this wonderful passage from Machiavelli, I love it so much. He says, "When evening comes, I return home and enter my study, and on the threshold I take off my workday clothes, covered with mud and dirt, and put on the garments of court and palace. Fitted out appropriately, I step inside the venerable courts of the ancients." He means, of course, his personal library, where he has the writings of the ancients that he's about to consult. Right. "Where, solicitously received by them, I nourish myself on that food that alone is mine and for which I was born, where I'm unashamed to converse with them and to question them about the motives for their actions, and they, out of their human kindness, answer me. And for 4 hours at a time, I feel no boredom, I forget all my troubles, I do not dread poverty, and I am not terrified by death. I absorb myself into them completely." Now, it's a very sophisticated way of expressing that pre-modern attitude towards the wisdom of the past. But the idea of cumulative development over time is generally absent. Now, these conceptions of the past are all very different. As I've said, in practice, they often overlapped. And they had the central feature in common: tradition was a trust, a gift from our ancestors, which it was our life's duty to hand on to our children. Um, biography of the famous, and as I say, several of these things remain with us still. The focus on great men, well, that's in some ways still with us, not in Machiavelli's form. You go out into the bookshops in Cambridge, there's plenty of biographies of the famous and the infamous, perhaps more popular than ever, even if we no longer agree with Thomas Carlyle's dictum that history is the biography of great men. Because it's much more than Carlyle's gender specificity that we'd reject. Increasingly, since the 18th century, scholarly and popular attention has focused on social, economic, and cultural developments as the drivers of historical change, and I think quite rightly so. But this brings us back to the Christian linear view of history. As we mostly all realise, the period from the mid-17th century through to the age of Napoleon saw increasing secularisation, not so much of populations in general, as of politicians, legal processes, philosophers, shapers of high culture in particular. We generally refer to the period as the Enlightenment, a usage to which I defer out of sheer sloth, for with advancing senility I have not the energy to contest every received opinion on every single point, but with little clue as to why Christians should concur in a value judgment so greatly at variance with the facts and which damns religion as darkness, right? You think about what we mean by the Enlightenment, it means the growing secularization of thought, art, culture, philosophy, etc. Right? I think we need to question that. Be all that as it may, the Christian linear view of history was not among the things abandoned by Enlightenment thinkers. Indeed, it was enhanced, or rather, it was rerouted. And this brings us to a very interesting character. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the work, maybe the broadcast sometimes, of the philosopher, the political philosopher John Gray. Now, Gray is an atheist. And in some ways, he is so consistent an atheist that he runs quite close to the thinking of religious people. He holds people like Dawkins in utter scorn, right, as bringing a bad reputation to atheism. But he's written extensively on this point. On his reading, in the Enlightenment, Christian teleology remained, only with a new secular telos. Instead of heading towards the kingdom of God, we're now heading towards a man-made utopia on earth that we can create with the right ideas. The kingdom of heaven is replaced by a range of earthly utopias, which must thenceforth be pursued with all the energy godly Christians had once invested in the pursuit of the celestial kingdom. Now, early 17th century England, before this time, saw the emergence of a new eschatology, post-millennialism. According to it, Christ returns only after, post, the millennial reign of the saints on earth. Now this raises the rather obvious question. If Jesus doesn't come back until after there's been a millennial reign of the saints on earth, who or what brings in the reign of the saints? And the answer is unavoidable. The saints. Right? Now the early history of post-millennialism is extremely disreputable. It was frequently the creed of nutters. But in the 18th century, it became much more respectable. The 18th century leaders of the Great Awakening, Jonathan Edwards and John Wesley, espoused this view. And in the late 18th and early 19th century, most evangelicals did. According to them, the world was destined to become more and more Christian, until at last, as Jonathan Edwards said, the time of the kingdom of heaven upon earth would coincide with a time of the greatest temporal, which in this context means material, prosperity. This is where John Gray comes in. He argues that the Enlightenment thinkers adopted this direction of thought, secularized it, and developed the progress myth on the basis of it. Human society was inevitably improving, and this was the trajectory of history. So it's a Christian linear view, taken over and secularized. The secular utopias postulated by Enlightenment thinkers, and even more importantly, by the political ideologues who applied their ideas to concrete programs. These were, Gray argues, religions without being aware of it. The ideologists were sure they knew where history was going. What were or are those utopias? Now, we've already mentioned some, I think, but because this is just a single lecture, I want to draw attention to the two that were to become by far the most important: nationalism and socialism. The 18th and 19th centuries witnessed pell-mell modernization in the West as countries industrialized and urbanized. Britain led the way in the 18th century, and it was followed a couple of generations later by the rest of the West. In the developing world, the process is still going on. As this happened, old forms of identity fell away or became less meaningful. Pre-modern people had seen themselves, and in some parts of the world still see themselves, as being who they are in relation to family, immediate location or community, lord or landlord or social superior, and religious community. I am the son or daughter of Griffith ap Rhodri ap Owain, who is a servant of Lord Rees of Penmaen Mawr in the parish of Dwig y Falchi. In North Wales, as some of you know, they talk as though they're being strangled like that. Okay. But if I'm a spinning machine miner in a vast cotton mill in early 19th century Bolton, a town perhaps far from where I was born, that form of identification no longer has any meaning. The same is true, however, if I'm a relatively well-heeled member of one of the new professions, a journalist, say, born in the foothills of the Alps, but living and working in Turin. Right? That whole traditional way of saying who you are no longer means anything. You go into, I don't know, the Maghreb today and get away from the coast in Algeria or something, probably people will still talk about themselves in that way. Right? But it's dying out as people are experiencing mass urbanization and modernization. So during this period of rapid population growth, urbanization, industrialization, two forms of identity resonated most strongly with the lived experience of ordinary people in urban areas: nation and class. Now, for those of you who are non-historians, it might come as a surprise that these categories are entirely modern. If that's you, for the sake of brevity, please accept my assurances on the point that this is not at all controversial. We will get to controversial bits later on, but this isn't it. Right. To be sure, the term nation has long been around. It's in the Bible, for goodness sake. Right? But before modern times, it meant something different, vaguer, and less salient to an individual's sense of identity. Think about the Native American Iroquois Nation, Susquehanna Nation, and so on. Very close to the way nation is used in the Bible, right? As these new forms of identity, sense of solidarity, became salient, that became how more and more people came to think of who they were and to define their imagined solidarity group. So modern ideologies were increasingly predicated upon them. Nationalism upon nation. Right? Nationalism can't exist unless being part of a particular nation is salient to your sense of who you are. Right? Similarly, socialism can't exist unless a class identity is salient to how you think of yourself. And much of the history of the world in the past two centuries could be written in terms of them. Of these two, it was nationalism that emerged earlier and faster and proved to have the greater lasting impact. Well, that's obvious. Nationalism is still with us. Fading a bit, but it's still with us. Socialism, not. But both were in sharp conflict from an early date with religious institutions and teachings. And that was true even where, as in, for example, Catholic Poland, or after 1896 with the emergence of Zionism, religion was held to be a crucial element in determining nationhood. Even there, religious authorities opposed the development of nationalism. Partly this was because the modern ideologies were greatly more egalitarian than traditional society, which they sought to supplant. Right? So if you are a Hungarian nationalist, that will tend to be dismissive of a hierarchical view of Hungarian society. It will tell you that what matters, we're all Hungarians. Huh, that's what counts. And we're being pushed around by those horrible Austrians, and we ought to push around those horrible Croats who are scarcely human, or something like that. Right? It's more egalitarian. Right? And socialism, well, it doesn't even need explaining. We understand that. Most religious institutions were deeply embedded with the mechanisms of the older society. Right? So non-egalitarian. And most importantly for our purposes, it was because the modern ideologies were rationalist, Enlightenment-spawned constructs built around several axioms, liberty, equality, and fraternity, for example. Whereas religions, by contrast, carry the freight of centuries of experience, of doctrinal accretions, and above all, an awareness of the impenetrable complexity of human relations and the human psyche. Right? Modern ideologies want to blow that all away with their three or four unanswerable axioms or something that somehow explain everything. Right? Religions, properly understood, don't actually work that way. Well, let's turn to the principal protagonist of class solidarity and the ideology predicated upon it, socialism. Karl Marx. Men, he said, make their own history, but they do not make it as they please. They do not make it under self-selected circumstances, but under circumstances existing already, given and transmitted from the past. The tradition of all dead generations weighs like a nightmare on the brains of the living. And just as they seem to be occupied with revolutionizing themselves and things, creating something that didn't exist before, precisely in such epochs of revolutionary crisis, they anxiously conjure up the spirits of the past to their service, borrowing from them names, battle slogans, and costumes in order to present this new scene in world history in time-honored disguise and borrowed language. Now, as with so much that Marx wrote, there is the usual mixture here of profound insight and complete bunkum. Do people make their own history? Well, I'm inclined to think they do. Are they, as Marx avers, nevertheless constrained by the history that's been made before their own lifetimes and of which they themselves are therefore the products? Undoubtedly. As C.S. Lewis says in The Abolition of Man, there is a sense in which all possible future generations are the patients or subjects of a power wielded by those already alive. Such that the last men, he says, will be of all men most subject to the dead hand of the past and will themselves exercise least power upon the future. I keep, as with so much in that book, I keep thinking about what he says there and about his relevance for the present. You know, I mean, if we really are staring down the barrel of ecological catastrophe, our agency is limited because it has been created by the generations before us that have devastated the planet, and to say the least, limited our room for manoeuvre. But Marx has a troubling problem. As a materialist, he thinks that we are decisively and only the product of material forces, whether past or ongoing. What is called you is merely the sum total of all those historical exigencies, including your genetic inheritance, your social conditioning, and in the present, your digestion, state of tiredness, current alignment of hormones, state of anxiety, etc. And that's it. That's who you are. The Christian will say that even taking account of all those things, there is still a you who can choose X rather than Y, or vice versa, or something else entirely. That's because the Christian believes that we're made in the image of God, who did not merely make the material universe and is immanent within it, but is also transcendent, who has, as it were, one foot outside and so can act without being acted upon. Admittedly, God has, in the Christian account of the matter, created vulnerabilities within himself to the point of being incarnated as a man, but that, as the kids say, is a whole another story. Conversely, humans have nothing like God's degree of freedom, but as a mirror image of God's situation, they are within the physical world, but they have a foot, or at least a few toes, outside, such that they are real selves, who are not merely driven by external forces or body chemistry, but can act in the full sense of that word. That's why we praise you, we praise one another if we do something good. We blame one another if somebody does something bad, right? Because the implication of that is immediately, you could have done other than you did, right? There is an actual choosing you, and that reflects the fact that you are created in the image of God. You are not simply a material or sociological or biological artifact. And this is a problem for Marx. None of this is really open to him. As he himself said, man is not an abstract being crouching outside the world. Man is the world of men, the state, society. Matter being all there is, you're locked inside. A social product, end of story. But he can't leave it at that, because he wishes to exhort you and me to rebel. Well, we might, or we might not. Right? To overthrow all existing order and usher in a socialist paradise. To say this scheme demands a choosing self, a person who might or might not do these things, would be an understatement. Indeed, from reading Marx, it's impossible not to conclude that he viewed himself, at an absolute minimum, as precisely that. An abstract being crouching outside the world, seeing it for what it really was, and critiquing it accordingly. Well, who is he? God? On his view of the world, there's no basis for him saying that. To look no further than his dismissal of religion, he said its abolition as the illusory happiness of the people is the demand for their real happiness. According to him, religious believers merely thought they were thinking when, in fact, they were caught up by social forces, the ideologization of capitalism beyond their understanding. That's why they were religious. Indeed, culture, ethics, art, social mores in general are, in Marxist jargon, mere superstructure built on the true foundations of economic relations, material relations. Marx, despite his own analysis, necessarily believed himself to stand outside of all this fog, to be able, in fact, to see that reality for what it was. And he urges us to do likewise, as though on his account of things we have a choice in the matter. I'm labouring my pillorying of Marx here. I think the point by now is obvious, right? And then we have this. Let's go back to his passage here. The tradition of all dead generations, he says, weighs like a nightmare on the brains of the living. Now, by the time that Marx wrote these words in 1852, they had become a platitude of modernist intellectuals of all stripes. Unlike pre-moderns, for whom tradition and the ways of our ancestors were a resource and an authority, for Enlightenment ideologues and certainly for Marx, the tradition of all dead generations was a millstone, a burden from which we needed to be loosed, a nightmare from which we needed to awake. Or, to shift the metaphor a little, we're back with Rousseau and the chains from which he'd insisted we need liberating. None of the modernist ideologies doubted what we needed liberating from: the accumulated wisdom of the human past, which required tearing up and destroying. But there was little agreement concerning to what we ought to be liberated. That is, about what might constitute freedom. For nationalists, socialists, neoconservatives, feminists, and a host of others, all of them are the unwitting slaves of Plato. All labour under the misconception that freedom is a thing when it isn't. Well, it is. It's a word. It's the noun or form of the adjective free. Hence, it only applies to specifics. It cannot, any more than blueness, serve as a general principle, a res, or a telos. Indeed, Westerners, and those elsewhere on the planet foolish enough to take them seriously, would have spent the 19th and 20th centuries killing one another by the tens of millions in their attempts to decide what did or did not constitute freedom. But it would all be worth it, they felt, still feel, as long as the right ideology won in the end. Now, finally, Marx observes with humour and irony that nationalist agitators of his own day, anxious to sweep away the old monarchies so that the people could take charge and tear down the multi-ethnic states in the cause of fabricating pure new ones, he said that these nationalists, Marx said, were busily conjuring up the spirits of the past to their service. They were reworking, mythologizing, or outright fabricating national pasts that would justify the nation states they wished to create, in order, he said, to present this new scene in world history in time-honoured disguise and borrowed language. Quite right, nationalists have continued to play the mendacious game down to the present. To visit Hero Square in Budapest, for example, with its pantheon of national heroes statues dating back to Arpad in 900 AD and King Stephen in 1000, is to contemplate wryly whether any of them, until, at best, the late 18th century, would have recognised themselves in the role their statuary now requires them to play. Socialists like Marx have generally been more honest than nationalists in being open about their desire to wipe clean the slate of the past and simply to obliterate the tradition of all dead generations that Marx considered such a nightmare. But not always. The first chapter of the Communist Manifesto, that definitive text of the Marx-Engels opus, begins, and you know this, with the famous words, "The history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggle," which is as grotesque a misrepresentation of the past as one might hope to find in the most fatuous high school essay. The past, it seems, is a treasure trove in which everybody finds what he wants, co-opts it for his own ends, and distorts the consciousness and intentions of the real inhabitants of that past in a latter-day cause. Try not to laugh. If history's any guide, the same fate awaits us. And in that rather different meaning of Marx's words, men do make their own history and make it just as they darn well please. They cut out the past to tell themselves a consoling story about what they want to believe in the present. That, of course, isn't what Marx meant. But. Okay, so we got that. Right. These two modern identities, nation and class, and the ideologies constructed on them, reached a decisive victory at the same moment at the end of World War I. The reconfiguration of Europe in the wake of the First World War saw the birth of the first socialist country via the Russian Revolution and the Civil War that followed it. Meanwhile, the Versailles Peace Conference redrew the map of Europe on the basis of President Woodrow Wilson's national self-determination. The notion that war would be forfended for the future by creating nation states, such that each nation would have its own state and have borders drawn accordingly. Now, it's long been the received view that the resultant settlement was a principal cause of World War II 20 years later. The Canadian historian, Margaret Macmillan, one of the leading authorities, perhaps the leading authority on the period, has challenged this view somewhat in her best-selling and seminal 2001 work, Paris 1919. Or is it called Peacemakers over here? One's the American, one's the British one. Anyway, either Peacemakers or Paris 1919. She argues that the received judgment of the peacemakers has been much too harsh, that the treatment of Germany was not excessive and was not the cause of the rise of Hitler, that the leading statesmen made a relatively good job of settling territorial boundaries given the constraints upon them. This line of argument has the effect of bolstering the reputation of her great-grandfather, David Lloyd George, but that is no doubt the merest coincidence. Now, without wading too far into this argument, I want to venture to suggest that she's right, that the political constraints on the statesmen were indeed severe. The state of their knowledge was obscured by countless partisans engaged in special pleading. But in fact, I'm rather more impressed by the historian Dominic Levin in his book The End of Tsarist Russia. He points out that whatever the immediate circumstances of 1919, ignoring the interests of the country that would naturally dominate Central Europe, Germany, which had been defeated, and the country that would naturally dominate Eastern Europe, Russia, which was convulsed in civil war and whose communism represented a threat to everyone else, this could not possibly produce an enduring peace. As soon as those two powers had recovered any degree of strength, he says, the peace settlement would be challenged. And when you consider the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of August 1939, that's exactly what happened. The point I'd want to emphasize is a bit different. The task the peacemakers had set themselves was intrinsically impossible, and so it could not but fail. There were no state borders that could be drawn which would not leave large ethnic minorities in a state dominated by others. So there were countless millions of people who were of ethnically mixed ancestry, speakers of several languages, who would now be forced to choose one identity over another, or more realistically, to have the choice made for them. Finally, there were many millions more who still did not think of themselves in national terms at all. Indeed, without in the least dismissing Margaret Macmillan's valuable arguments, I'd actually want to ramp up the traditional judgment a bit. In my reading, World War I is the definitive catastrophe of the modern era from which most other evils, not just World War II, have flowed. In that reading, the destruction of the old multi-ethnic empires created a crisis of legitimacy which the modernist ideologies failed to fill and never could fill, a crisis which has issued in a torrent of blood more or less ever since and from whose consequences we remain far from free. Something that my students in America, but most people in Britain as well, we failed to take account of why we have, in general, secure lives and secure politics. We don't expect civil war or border conflicts with neighbours. And the reason is extremely simple, but we've come to take it for granted. And it's something achieved only with the greatest difficulty. And that is, we live in states where almost everybody who lives within the frontiers of the state accepts the legitimacy of that state. Absent that, and you have a recipe for war. Right? And what the peace settlement at the end of World War I does is to destroy old multi-ethnic states. They were becoming extremely ragged because of the impact of modernist ideologies, most notably nationalism, actually, but in Russia, of course, socialism too. And that creates a situation in which the new states do not have 100% recognition of legitimacy by the people who live within them. And that is a disaster, because that creates ongoing instability, which, in fact, we have suffered ever since. The Habsburg space, let's say, Central Europe, did not get to a place of new stability. That is, states in which pretty much everybody who lived within them recognizes legitimate until the late 1990s. And if you look at the Ottoman Empire, it's an even bigger disaster. Every single conflict in the Middle East, the Israel-Palestine conflict not excepted, is a direct consequence of the failure to achieve that kind of acceptance of legitimacy since the end of World War I, since the disintegration of the Ottoman Empire. So it's really crucial. And the interwar period saw the drastic radicalization, you know this from your school history, right, of nationalism and socialism. And in both cases, the development was triggered not by political failure, but by political success. And in both cases, the success revealed that the utopias were unrealizable. Now we're getting onto the controversial bit. Right? And something I think Christians need to imbibe to be able to show the irrationality of rationalist ideologies. Let's deal with nation first. Certainly the 19th century had seen the creation of new nation states: Serbia, Greece, Italy, Germany, Romania, Bulgaria. But in each case, the statehood had been tempered by combination with a monarchy. Monarchs are more concerned with exercising government to secure domestic peace rather than expansionist programs abroad, although the fateful exception of Serbia is noteworthy. All monarchs were rightfully mistrustful of nationalists. Battery is running low. Okay, thank you. But do keep running, though. Hey. Okay, we can have that up now. The statehood was tempered by a combination with... Oh, yeah, okay, we said that, right. But all of that changes after 1919. The populist nationalists had been given their head by the peace agreement. The map of Europe was redrawn, supposedly on the basis of national self-determination. The vanquished states lost territory and people. The resentment among Hungarians was particularly bitter. 30% of Magyars now lived outside the new mini-Hungary. Germans lived in the newly created Poland, and a few even in Belgium. Turkey and Greece resolved their mutual minorities issue only after a savage war from 1919 to 22, following which 1.6 million people were exchanged between the two countries, the poisonous ramifications of which continue to bedevil the present. 1 in 8 of the population of Bulgaria was still Turkish. Almost a third of the newly recreated state of Poland were not Poles. The creation of Yugoslavia produced a new set of ethnic resentments of almost mind-numbing complexity. Romania had extremely large numbers of Hungarians, Germans, Jews, as well as Bulgarians, Turks, Ruthenes, and Serbs. Almost all states in the centre and east of the continent had important populations of Jews and Germans, especially in the towns. Half the continent, it seemed, was claimed, or at least desired, by multiple states, all of whom claimed the same territory as part of their inalienable homeland. And the result was severe domestic instability. In all states, internal politics, dominated by ethnic tensions, fused with the economic dislocation caused by the breakup of the old empires to create a perfect storm. And that was before the worldwide depression struck in 1929. Between all states, resentments smouldered for the same reasons. All were fearful of losing what the peace settlement had granted them. Almost all were determined to seize territory they had been denied. And in all countries, majority populations looked for scapegoats, finding them almost universally in the Jews and nearly as frequently in other minorities. And this in spite of the fact that many individuals knew themselves to be ethnic mixtures. But nationalism's rival had also been given its head for the first time, not by the statesmen in Versailles, but by the Russian Revolution of 1917 and the bloodbath of a civil war that followed it. But as the next decade made painfully apparent, socialism didn't work either. Its shortcomings were so enormous, but also so apparent to any impartial observer, that the Soviet authorities took good care to let no impartial observers in. The collectivization of the farms was merely the most gigantic of the economic failures. It resulted in mass starvation that led to at least 3 million deaths, and perhaps as many as 15 million, depending on whom you wish to believe, because gathering information was made almost impossible. The communist-inclined Malcolm Muggeridge was one of the few trusted foreigners allowed in, but it was enough to deconvert him. The horror of what he witnessed gave him the first push on his path towards Christian faith. "My disillusionment," he said, "with the notion of a predestined progress towards a kingdom of heaven on earth led me inexorably back to the kingdom not of this world, proclaimed in the Christian Revelation." And here at last is the first of my two crucial points. Political success, followed by crippling problems, did not make the supporters of nationalism or socialism more moderate. It did not cause them to tinker with the mechanisms of their ideologies to account a little better for reality. On the contrary, it generated drastic, murderous radicalization. Okay, so socialism finally attains power in a major country after World War I, and nationalism at the same time. In each case, political success was a prelude to disappointment. and revealed the ideologies to be delusions. But ideologues cannot admit this. And so instead of qualifying the ideology and becoming more realistic, they become angrier than before their political success was attained. They blame obstructionism and they become further radicalized. Now, I think, and I don't want to name any particular ideologies because I too fancy staying alive a little longer, that we see this process going on today, actually, with different ideologies. Now, forests of paper have been consumed in the difficult attempt to define fascism, and I have no further refinements here. But if the term means anything at all, and I think it does, it certainly means nationalism on steroids. Nationalism turned from 19th century liberalism and parliamentarism to totalitarianism, militarism, authoritarianism. It represents the anger of disappointed nationalists, certain that enemies and conspirators are to blame for the failure of the dream, because the dream itself and the ideology that fueled it could not be allowed to be delusions. The failure of utopia must be due to Jews and other ethnic minorities, to capitalists and to communists. Similarly with socialism. It could not be admitted that the ideology did not conform to reality. The entire emotional, professional and social lives of its protagonists have been invested, often at great personal risk, into realizing the socialist project, the telos of history. That it didn't work was simply impossible. Much better to insist it was being frustrated by obstructionist peasants, petty bourgeois elements, foreign spies and domestic saboteurs. This is most clearly seen in the Stalinist purges of the late 1930s, in which engineers and managers were forced to accuse themselves of sabotage or of being secret fascists and then executed. The better to explain the failures in production that socialist planning had made inevitable. Now, this is a general feature of rationalist ideologies born of the Enlightenment. They are irrational. And in espousing them, the ideologues become so too. But this is a reality precisely opposite to their own self-image. They are the spokeswomen for applied rationality, right, in their own minds. That's what they see themselves as being. So opposite that many ideologues would rather die than confront the reality which their very political success has made apparent. In the 1920s, 30s and 40s, most chose instead, actually, that the human obstacles to their programs should die instead. Because ideologies have a strong appeal and a price. The appeal of an ideology is the sense of intellectual omniscience they give to the person who embraces them. If you embrace an ideology, you feel intellectually omniscient. Everything suddenly becomes understood in the light of your three or four unchallengeable axioms. Right. And it also gives you a sense of superior righteousness. You're on the side of history. You see things for what they really are. The price, however, is permanent unhappiness. Not because the world around fails to conform to the ideal posited by the ideology, but because it never can and never will. And for the person addicted to the adrenaline of righteous anger thereby produced, the ideology can be a cruel master, but one it is hard to give up. Does this perhaps help us to understand some of the political anger that we see around us? This was the situation in the 1930s and 1940s, as it is again, albeit under different circumstances now. The Enlightenment-derived ideologies, each consisting of a small cluster of axioms or of postulates about the world, do not, cannot describe the full complexity even of the human condition, still less of the universe as a whole. That complexity was enshrined in the geological layers of inherited tradition and of religious wisdom, which modernity brushed aside as oppressive and obscurantist clutter. Vaunting themselves as the products of rationalism, the secular religions are more profoundly irrational than the ancient faiths they brushed aside, a point with which the atheist John Gray wholeheartedly agrees. For a reason, it should be remembered, is a methodology. It can only ever speak to us of means, not of ends. Knowledge of ends can come to us only from elsewhere, which brings us back to the religion that the Enlightenment-inspired ideologies rejected. That being so, it's hardly surprising that so many different ideologies arose, some favouring unfettered capitalism, others statism, some nationalist or racist, others universalist, some atomising in their individualism, as with John Stuart Mill, others insisting with Rousseau that men must be forced to be free. And differing as they did in their diagnoses, their protagonists became bitterer enemies of one another than any of them had been to the Ancien Régime. And when the last of the old monarchies and multi-ethnic empires had been finally destroyed in 1919, the competing ideologues fell upon one another like ravening wolves. In their eyes, no crime could be greater than to adhere to the wrong ideology. That also sounds familiar today, doesn't it? In a world that believed ever less in Christian morality and Christian conceptions of sin, ideological purity moved into the space vacated by virtue, and the wrong politics into that vacated by sin. And if fascism and communism are now, for most purposes, dead, virtue signalling and demonisation of people for their politics remain with us in full force. That's what World War II was all about. The heart of the war, the place where the large majority of corpses piled up, was the clash between the most monstrous and grotesque form of the nation ideology, Nazi Germany and its numerous allies, and its exact equivalent in respect of the class ideology, Stalin's Soviet Union. Finally, the Enlightenment-derived ideologies are all, finally, atheistic. Now, at first blush, that statement might sound like an exaggerated version of what everybody knows anyway. They're all pretty much secular is hardly in dispute. I don't think anybody would argue that. Many or most arose as ideas specifically directed against churchly powers. Well, we all know that. But surely my statement that they're all intrinsically atheistic must be an exaggeration. Protagonists of each have, after all, found ways of reconciling their ideas with some form of religious belief. Christian socialism was very much a thing, as the kids say, during the 19th century. During the fascist period, some movements even utilised religious identity as a weapon to combat communism, of course. But the traction always lay elsewhere. The Christian socialism was never more than a staging post on the way to an aggressively secular form. The rapprochement between some forms of fascism in some countries and their hereditary churches was never more than an arrangement of convenience. The fascist leader was always transparently non-religious. The believers always well aware that they were being used. Let who will draw contemporary parallels. Nationalism and socialism both began with a critique of the alliance between throne and altar, of the use of traditional churches to prop up regimes that the ideologues wished to destroy. Reorganize those churches, might be inferred. Reorient them away from their misuse, and nationalists and socialists might, at an individual level, be reconciled to them. But there would always remain a severe tension between the programs of the ideologues and received understandings of doctrine and of Christian teaching. People committed to modern ideologies, who wished nevertheless to retain their religious attachments, needed then, and still need, to change those traditional doctrines, to challenge traditional understandings of Scripture. Now, I'm wanting you to do the mental legwork yourself here to think about contemporary ideologies that have exactly this dynamic about them, where this is going on inside people's heads. Right? Well, I'm keeping myself alive by not naming them, but let's just talk about nationalism and socialism safely more in the past, right? Okay. To change those traditional doctrines, challenge traditional understandings of Scripture, it's a tricky undertaking and frequently not finally credible to the tweakers themselves. Political success has done damage to God analogous to that done to the ideologue's political enemies. The revelation that even given its head, an ideology doesn't work, doesn't increase the sum total of human happiness, meets intractable roadblocks at the level of practicality. All of these things tend over the long haul to destroy religious faith. Why? Because the ideologue's quarrel is finally with reality itself, a reality that pays no heed to their shrieking and their bullying, and unlike the population, simply cannot be coerced. And so the creator of reality was manifestly not on their side. Fury directed at oppressive churches and priests, which, as the Church of England shows us every day, can in any case be cowed along with everybody else, is for them beside the point. For the committed ideologue, God was, is, a sort of ultimate cosmic swine. It was perhaps the novelist Thomas Hardy who blazed their trail, abolishing God and then perpetually summoning him back into existence so that he could punch him again. How dare the created cosmos not conform to my petulant dogmas? Well, in conclusion, ideologies are still very much with us, but the progress myth that gave them their incandescent power is not. We bicker about race and sex. We moan about social inequalities. But the belief that a new world is around the corner, which an all-encompassing ideology can actualize, that's gone. Now we accuse each other of fascism, but the jackboots, the uniformed mass militia, and the stated intentions to invade our neighbours are missing. Students call themselves socialists, but the idea of seizing the means of production into the ownership of the toiling masses is the very last thing on their minds. Putting up with shoddy standardised products dictated by a centrally planned economy and a six-month wait before you can update your smartphone, they'd be the very first to complain. The future is dead. It's as dead as the past that modernity killed. I warned you we'd come back to Edward Burke. People will not look forward to posterity who never look backward to their ancestors. If our current ideologies have the ring of exasperated whining, it'll be because that's what they are. We lost this, didn't we? We just ran out of battery here. But what happens to people? What's left once we believe in neither the past nor the future? Sex and shopping. And then we wonder why we're lost souls with no meaning in our lives and no direction, because every possible avenue of meaning we have killed stone dead as either stupid or oppressive and limiting or both. In severing the root, tradition and the past, we've killed the flower, the future. Christians, there is a gap in the market. Our contemporaries, of course, do not want to listen to us. But that doesn't mean they have an alternative hope. Far from it. The churches of the period before 1789 aligned themselves with absolutist monarchies. And when those regimes came under pressure and were discredited, the Christianity was too. In America in particular, but elsewhere in the West in recent generations, churches have aligned themselves with a particular political agenda. And now that it stands discredited and contemptible, they do too. Nothing of any moment is to be gained by prostituting ourselves once more to the newly fashionable ideas in the hope of a fresh lease of life. Instead, we need to do what we should have been doing all along, pointing to a kingdom that is not of this world, even as we are salt and light in the present. Because whatever Christianity is, it is not a fig leaf to cover the embarrassment of the kingdoms of this world at their inability to reflect the powers of the age to come. And I'm sorry to have gone on for so long.